Good morning, good people. I'm Kiplin Primus, your host for The Local Take on Jazz 91.9 WCLK. And this morning, we're actually speaking with Bakari Sellers. Bakari Sellers, welcome to The Local Take.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm as blessed and fortunate to be on this platform with you. So thank you for having me this morning.
Well, I am really glad you're here, and I think it's, you know, wonderful timing, even though I know we're here to kind of talk about your book. This is still an amazing time to be alive and, you know, on the planet. So I'm glad that you're taking just a little bit of time to speak with us this morning. And your book is called Our Vanishing Country. And I would love it if you could just share a little bit about the book on your growing up in Denmark, South Carolina, and how you came to become a Morehouse man.
Yeah. So, you know, this book, it chronicles, and I like to say it chronicles the pain and trauma of what it means to be a black man in the South, a black man in America. You know, we start in Denmark, South Carolina, of course, where I'm from, a big city, as I like to say, with three stoplights and a blinking light. And it chronicles February 8th, 1968, which I say is the most important day of my life. That's the Orangeburg Massacre, in which three young men were killed, Henry Smith, Samuel Hammond, and Delano Middleton, and another 28 were wounded, where South Carolina State Troopers fired shots into a group of students as they were protesting what the history books call the last vestige of discrimination in Jim Crow's final hiding place. And, you know, from there, that's, you know, where my story began. And I talk about that in the chapter entitled Don't Be a Dead Hero. I got that title from a letter that my grandfather wrote my father asking him to come home and to cease his involvement in SNCC and in the movement. Of course, that didn't happen, but nevertheless, you know, my father's story is one and legacy is one that, you know, I just try to carry on. And the book goes all the way through my time at Morehouse, of course. It goes through my time being the youngest black elected official in the country, being 30 years old and securing the nomination for the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor in South Carolina. And, you know, we have ups and downs, successes, triumphs, and we even have, you know, Charleston, the Charleston Massacre, which we just recently commemorated 5 years since then, where I had a friend, Clemente Pinckney, who was murdered along with eight others. And so this is a book of triumph. This is a book of pain, book of trauma, perseverance, hope, and it takes you on an emotional roller coaster, but as is our life.
Now, you talked about being elected as the youngest state representative for the state of South Carolina right after you graduated from college. Basically, you were entering law school. You made that decision while you were still at Morehouse. How did you come to know at such a, you know, early point in your career that politics was what you wanted to pursue?
Well, you know, I had the opportunity to work for amazing people while I was at Morehouse. People like Jim Cleburne, people like Shirley Franklin, who taught me that it was about public service, not necessarily politics. It was, you know, it was unique because my parents, they told us you could be anything you wanted to be in the world as long as you were a change agent. And I set my sights on being a change agent through politics. My sister is in medicine, and she is deputy chief of staff at the Veterans Hospital. My brother in the ministry. And so we all chose these different avenues. For me, it was politics. And I, you know, one of my heroes, both in the movement and in politics, is Julian Bond. And I love Uncle Julian, and I just wanted to pattern myself after his politics, and was able to do so by being elected at such a young age.
Now, and if folks listening, Julian Bond was also one of the youngest state representatives elected here in the state of Georgia. You mentioned some of the chapters in your book, but one of the things that I noticed is that you have a chapter that speaks about black women. Why did you think we deserved a whole chapter?
That's easy. I mean, Black women have poured so much into me. I highlighted the struggles of my wife in giving birth and how she almost died during labor, which was tough on me, as you can possibly imagine. I highlighted all of those women who poured so much into me as I was growing up, who were a part of my village to raise a child. It's easy to talk about politics when you're talking about Black women because they're the backbone of our democracy, Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker. And so, you know, this is a love story to a lot, my love story to my father and mother, a love story to the South, but it's also a love story of Black women and lifting them up. And as we say in South Carolina, giving people their flowers while they're living.
I loved it. And I did, honestly, I loved that chapter. One of the other things that you talk about is your experience with anxiety. And in fact, you called anxiety your superpower. But as you know, there's still so many stigmas around mental health, and especially in our community and especially with men. Why do you think it's just so hard for us, you know, to face our emotions and to understand that occasionally you will need help?
Well, I mean, I think we have a perverted understanding of what masculinity and manhood is. You know, I was doing a radio show recently where a guy decided it was a good time to chastise me for shedding tears on TV in regards to George Floyd's death and some of the conflicting notions I had about raising a Black child in this America. And I just politely told him that, you know, I think we have the definition of manhood all types of jacked up, and my masculinity all types of jacked up, because for me, it's first and foremost being a good husband, being a good father. And the way that we do that is being willing to talk about the issues that are facing us directly. And I am unashamed. In fact, I'm very proud of how much progress I've made. You know, I talk about sometimes it feels like I'm getting stuck in my head. But Anyala Vincent told me it's not necessarily being stuck in your head. It's when you're in your head with no adult supervision, which I thought was a unique way to put it. But I'm trying to be more communicative, and I wanted people to know in that chapter that here I am. You see me on CNN. I have a beautiful wife, a great family, a great career. But sometimes I have struggles that I have to work through, and that makes me make the most of each 24-hour period.
And, you know, that makes you human. Every human on the planet at some point has a struggle that they might need help with.
And, you know, this is going to sound a bit humorous, but I always tell people that, you know, Black men, many times we think that the only person we can talk to about our issues is our barber. And I wanted people to know that it's okay to talk to your barber and a few other people about your issues.
Thank you. Could you continue to spread that word? One of the other things that you talked about was one of the reasons that you know, wanted to run from office was to have the Confederate flag that lived at one point on top of the State House in South Carolina and then had been moved, you know, to the front of the State House in South Carolina, and that you wanted that removed from the state capitol grounds. And I want you to know, I met Bree Newsom a few years ago, and honest and truthfully, I blubbered. I could hardly talk to her. And even in sending you the question, I started to get choked up. Why do you think it's so important that these symbols of nothing but hate, anyone who says heritage doesn't understand what the Civil War was about? But why was it so important, and why is it still so important for us to remove these symbols of hate?
Well, I think those symbols of hate, we have to remember when they were put up. The Confederate flag wasn't put up until the 60s in response to some of the racial progress we were making in this country. It wasn't a symbol of heritage by any stretch. And, you know, I'm one for taking this stuff down. I'm glad we're getting rid of Aunt Mama. I'm glad Uncle Ben's is changing his name. And doing all of those things. However, not just the symbolism. I want to know how many Black folks you have in your C-suite, how many people are you promoting, how many people are you listening to for executive decision, your executive team. Those are the things that really matter if we're going to have systemic and institutionalized change. I, for one, I would have never, if you would have bet me, you know, 5 years ago today, because the flag didn't come down until July of 2016. 15, excuse me. But if you would have bet me 5 years ago today, I would have told you that the flag was never coming down. I would have bet you dollars to donuts that it would never come down. But I'm glad it did, because it allows me to breathe again. The fact we don't have to see that symbol of hate flying in front of our Capitol. But I want more than that. And I think most of us do as well.
When you mention you want more, you mentioned the C-suite. You know, we're talking about how African-Americans are disproportionately dying in the COVID-19 pandemic. And I've heard lots of talk about health equity. For the first time this year, I talked to the superintendent of Atlanta Public Schools, and she talked about equity in education. These are the systems that everyone is referring to when they mention systemic racism. Do you think the country is ready to face these systems being deconstructed, or is this just more, you know, lip service and cosmetics?
I don't know the answer to that, because we've been here before, right? This isn't the first time we're here. We've been here before with Emmett Till. We've been here before with the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We've been here before with the Charleston Massacre, and nothing has changed. And so trust but verify is an old political saying, which is very prudent right now. Trust but verify. Take it one day at a time. Don't give out participation trophies. I appreciate Mitt Romney for saying Black Lives Matter, but that's all he said. You know, it wasn't an initiative. It wasn't a policy point. It wasn't anything else. He just said it. And so I appreciate that. But I want to see the follow through. We know that, you know, the scripture, just like I know the scripture, faith without works is dead. And so let's see what the work looks like, because it's hard work. And we'll see what happens over the next, you know, week.
You mentioned we've been here before. And I'm so, you know, I switch between being very hopeful and very cynical, I guess is the right word. And we make the progress. And then as soon as we think, OK, we're good, and people relax, you know, someone comes in and sticks a fly in the buttermilk. Can we make change that becomes stable change? Or is this something where we will always have to, you know, look and listen and watch and, you know, stand over it so much that you can't be free because you're watching the people who are trying to oppress you?
That's an interesting question. That's a really good question. That's also a very loaded question. I honestly think that while we are championing the Taylor Swift and the Roger Goodells and the One Pelotons and the Bluebells and the Ben and Jerry's, you know, in all of these corporations, while we're championing all of them, I think we have to, again, be very cautious. And, you know, you ask a good question about watching them and monitoring them. Those are things we have to do. We have to be vigilant. We've always been a vigilant people. And this time is no different. You know, freedom is anything but free. And I think we've learned that. If we didn't know it, or if people forgot, they've learned it over the past year.
Now, Twitter is a very interesting, you know, social media platform to me. And we share something in common. We have both been blocked by the current occupant of the White House.
Look at that. Welcome to the club. I don't know when you were blocked, but I'm glad you're here.
I was blocked before he was elected. I actually remember the tweet that got me blocked. It was about Islamic radical terrorism. And, you know, everyone was up in arms because Obama and Biden wouldn't say those three words. And I just simply asked, what is it, like Beetlejuice? You know, if you say Beetlejuice three times, something happens. If you say Islamic radical terrorism, does something happen? And the next thing I know, I was blocked. So you were blocked. I'm blocked. But like him, I often, you know, look at news, look at CNN, and you tweet what you hear. You tweet what's being said. And I think it was last week I was watching you on CNN. And you were very emotional, and, you know, no one can blame you because we're all very emotional in this time. But someone tweeted, oh, my God, how does Bakari Sellers not explode? So, Bakari Sellers, how are you able to be on camera, you know, give the right responses, give intelligent, you know, morally correct responses, and not explode when people come back at you with something that is so ignorant and so, you know, inhumane. How do you keep your calm there?
I don't have, you know, much of a choice. My father gave me a good piece of advice that I write about. He said, never argue with a fool because people watching can't tell the difference. And I also never try to be angry. I just try to get my point across, which is more difficult sometimes than not. But I understand that the reflection of myself is what many white folk, that's the way that they look at black men in America these days. And I have to be on top of my game. And I have to be willing to go and speak the truth and speak truth to power and stand in it. And those convictions are why I think I do well on TV, because I will tell my truth and I will be willing to stand in it. A lot of people aren't at that point anymore.
And in standing in it, I remember the day, that Friday, that Omar Jimenez was arrested on the air doing his job. And that was the day when I saw you standing in power, because I was scared for him. I didn't know what was going to happen.
You know, he's a member of Ebenezer Baptist Church. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah, his mom is one of my classmates. So, yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So I was deeply afraid for him, and it was surreal, because at that time I was deeply afraid for him because he kept trying to talk. I was like, Omar, put your mic down. He kept trying to talk into the microphone. I was like, stop. And it was palpable, and the control room could hear me. But then it was like you were commenting from a perspective of being black to the entire world, because a lot of people were caught up on the First Amendment aspect of them arresting a person of the media, which is bad in itself. But I was just more focused on them arresting a black man, understanding that they had just killed one the week prior. And so, you know, commenting on something like that live was very, very difficult. I'm just glad. And he's such a bad man. He's one of our best. I mean, he is really, really good at what he does. And he's going to be around for a very long period of time. And I'm just glad he was okay. I mean, he came back out. He shook it off. I know he was embarrassed. I mean, I hate the way they humiliated him. But he came back out, shook it off, and did his job better than anybody we had on the network. And so my hat's off to his mother, his grandmother, everybody at Ebenezer Baptist Church for, you know, pouring so much into who is a very, very strong part of CNN and the CNN family.
Now, you mentioned at the start of this interview, the start of our conversation, you spoke about the Orangeburg massacre, which your father was wounded in. And you talk about that trauma being a part of your life. Can you imagine what the trauma our community is going into right now, the trauma that we are existing in? What do you think that's going to do in the future? And, you know, I'm thinking about the video that's gone viral of the 10-year-old African-American boy who literally hides when he sees the police coming down the street.
I don't know the impact of that. I mean, I think that I know it's going to be devastating. I know there are going to be people with a ton of issues that come out of this. Because it's an interesting porn fetish that this country has, watching black people die in the street. And we see it so often. I mean, how many times do we have to see the video of Brooks running with his back turned in the Wendy's parking lot? How many times did we see the 8 minutes and 46 seconds of George Floyd? How many times did we see Ahmaud Arbery? And then ironically, when they killed Breonna Taylor, their body cameras weren't on. So I'm not sure we know what the trauma will be. I just know it's going to be there. And then so many of us are dying through and because of COVID. The overlay of that in 5 years is going to be decently traumatic, and we'll see how much of a price we truly paid.
So one last question about our current times. You talked about the it's almost pornographic the way they continue to share these videos of black men, you know, being killed. I haven't been able to watch any of them. I'm trying to take care of my mental health. But I have said it's the culture in police departments. It's not the police, it's the culture. And the only way that you can change the culture of any organization is almost to start over. Because there are going to be some people, no matter what change comes, no matter what incentive comes, they're holding on to that culture. So is it, I think more than defund, it's disband. Start a peace patrol as opposed to a police patrol. If you could do it yourself, if you could say this is what policing is going to look like, and, you know, thinking about the 21st century policing that Obama and Biden left us with, if you could build the police department, what would it look like?
You know, I think we have to reimagine the way that we police in this country, reimagine it. And I think that from a federal level, I have some very tangible solutions. I think that we need to have a nationalized database for misconduct, because right now, and we have to not just encourage, but mandate that every city, county, local, state, you know, agency, federal agency, all abide by it. Because right now you can get fired for beating somebody in Macon, Georgia, and go down to Albany and be chief of police, right? And we don't have any database where we can document that misconduct. I think we need a nationalized use of force, standardized use of force guidelines, so that the public knows what's in the use of force training. So there's no question that when you shoot somebody in the back and they're not a threat, even if he had a taser that was operable and this one was not, but even if he had one that was operable, we know that that's not a lethal weapon. That's no question. This is a murder, point blank, period. You know, what would it look like? I would trim the fat. You know, I would, I am somebody who believes that defunding the police is a horrible, horrible name for what we want to do. But I don't think it's anything wrong with when Republicans reduce a budget, they call it trimming the fat. And I think that's the same thing we should do. There's no police department that should have a Humvee or drone or rocket launchers or tanks. And people may be shaking their head, but there are police departments with that right now in the street. And I want to take those dollars and I want to redirect them to social services, mental health programs, after school programs, summer jobs, work programs, all of those things. But until we break the grip of our police unions, we still have a long way to go.
Now, you're everyone is saying you can't say defund because people don't like that. But they defund education. They defund housing. We all know that teachers are buying paper, pencils, pens, crayons, and everything else that they need. Why can't police buy bullets? I mean, I really don't understand why we can defund any and everything else, but we can't defund the police department.
I don't necessarily think you're wrong. I just think that people are asking questions about what the what those three words mean. And, you know, because what we're no one is saying that when you dial 911 because somebody's been shot or raped or beaten, that the police aren't going to show up. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that there's no reason for the police to be 50-55% of your city budget when you can utilize those monies and pay for mental health programs. You know, why are police the first ones called when there's a mental health issue anyway? And police will tell you the same thing. They would ask the question, why are they the first ones called? So we just have to reimagine what policing looks like in this country. That's the biggest thing.
Now, Bakari Sellers, the title of your book is My Vanishing Country. Do you think we'll ever get back to those times when small towns like Denmark, South Carolina, you know, had their own hospital, had jobs that people could make a living at, had factories, had manufacturing? Is that country gone forever? Is that something we want to get back to? What is the answer for those small southern rural communities, black and white, that are struggling just to survive?
The answer to the question is we have to begin to uplift those voices. And there's so many people that we've forgotten about. You know, in this book, I try to give those voices life. I try to elevate them to where they belong. I am someone who believes that we can get back to a place, and it won't be the same, to answer your question. No, we won't go back to textile mills. But we can prepare kids throughout the rural South. Many of these black kids who are growing up in Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, there's no reason we can't prepare them for a 21st century global economy. I refuse to give up on them. I refuse to say that they're going to be punished because of the zip code that they're born into. I want them to have every opportunity to compete globally like every other child. And I think we have to gear ourselves to doing that. And yes, our country is vanishing. It's not just those country towns that are vanishing, but it's the ideals that are promised by this country. Not just life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but words like love and hope and truth and justice and peace. I want to recapture all of those things because my kids are 17 months and 15 years old, and I want them to be able to be free one day. That's my goal.
So if people want to get the book, where and how can they get it? And if people want to stay in touch with you beyond CNN, how can we do so?
So, you know, I'm on Instagram and Twitter. It's Bakari_Sellers on Twitter, Bakari Sellers on Instagram. You can get the book wherever it's sold on Amazon. It's one click. If you want to go to your local bookstore, please do. If you're having trouble finding it or it's out of stock, DM me, let me know. Or if you just want to tell me what you thought about it, I'm appreciative of all the support. And I just want to say thank you to you, because you didn't have to allow a country boy from Denmark this platform to be on your show. And I'm really grateful. I'm grateful for all of our African-American media. And I'm grateful for lifting up voices like mine.
Well, I am glad that you lifted up those voices, country boy from Denmark, South Carolina. You are talking to a country girl from Hammond, Louisiana. So thank you so much for lifting up those voices of folks that we sometimes miss. I do appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a blessed day.